This is a Power 98.7 podcast. Now we're talking. Subscribe to Power 98.7 podcasts in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. There's more on power987.co.za.
To Nairobi we have go next. Elections in Kenya have been passionately fought throughout, well, the past coming weeks and months, if you must, and the turnaround or the turnout has been high. Up to 80% of voters cast their ballots in the elections of August 2017. I think what you'll hear from Kenya today is that quite a high number also would have voted in this election. This election has galvanized the country. We speak to now the Kenyan blogger and journalist Daniel Ominda and researcher in the field of Pan-Africanism and African Renaissance. Saifa?
Good evening.
Is it Saifa?
Good evening,
How would you pronounce the name? Saifa Kidani. Saif Kidani.
Yeah.
And okay, and you're about to join us both. Well, let's see. Saif, where are you located? You're located where?
In
Johannesburg. And Daniel, you're in Nairobi.
Yes, I'm located in Nairobi.
Okay, and the election is done and dusted for now. I mean, the other, of course, would be protocol issues. Result, you know, talking about the electoral space and then, of course, the announcement and all of that. But done and dusted, is it, Daniel?
Well, it's largely done and dusted. We have small pockets of areas that are still voting, and basically that's because they had a few technical hitches with the voting machines, the voter identification machines in those particular areas, and in some very few instances we also have areas where voting materials got in late. Mm-hmm. In one particular area in the northeastern Kenya, which is basically a very volatile part of the country, there was a bit of skirmishes and insecurity situation last night, and that forced them to postpone the voting exercise to tomorrow, and that's just one constituency where
in essence one constituency, because of just logistical problems, will still be voting tomorrow, but in essence those people who are still in queues where they want to vote will be allowed to vote, and or yeah. Because you know, if they started late, obviously then the time schedules are made a bit longer as well. Is that what you're telling us?
Yeah, if they start late, the time schedules are compensated by how many hours they started late. But by now, I think most of the guys who are voting today should have really the exercise should have ended in their areas.
And it would have closed at 5 p.m. today. That's an early close, isn't it?
For most of the country, yes, because the polling stations, by the constitution, are supposed to open at 6 a.m. in the morning local time, and they're supposed to run until 5 p.m. local time. And then usually by provision is that in case there was some delay occasioned by system failure or lack of materials getting to the ground on time or any other disruption that might cause a stop to that exercise, then that time is compensated for.
Absolutely.
And also there's an allowance that by the time of close of the polling station, if somebody is still on the queue, then the person on the queue is allowed to vote.
Sure. Let's get to, and I'm going to stay with you, Daniel, before I get to you, Saif. Let's understand the enormity of this election. So there's a presidential election, but it's so much more than that, right? It's governors, senators, members of parliament, and all sorts of other members that need to be elected, right? So it's quite an enormous election. It's quite huge.
So Kenyan elections, by the nature of by the, how they're designed, are usually a huge exercise. So we have a general election instead of just a presidential election. So every 5 years we go to the polls and we elect six.
You said you have a general election instead of presidential elections.
Yes, so general election means we elect several other seats,
sure,
other than
absolutely.
the seat of the president. And in our case, there are six seats. We have election for the president, for the governor, because the country is divided into seven administrative units, and that's the second tier level of governance. So we have governors in those units. So we elect 47 of them. Then we also elect senators, 47 of them. And then we elect members of parliament. And then we have a woman member of parliament for each of those 47 jurisdictions. And then now we have what you guys call councillors or council members,
which is the county assembly.
Yeah, so we call them members of county assembly here.
Sure. And everybody is watching the presidential race, but all of these others are just as important as well, because it talks about representation, right?
Yes, I think from the international perspective, I know most people outside Kenya are watching the presidential race. But even when you come deep down into the country, you'll find that in certain areas or even across the country, the smaller races like the member of county assembly and the governor are actually more significant to the voters compared to the presidential vote in terms of the effect or the impact that it's going to have on their life because of our system of governance as a country. But yes, the presidential debate. The presidential race is usually given that sort of prominence for obvious reasons.
Daniel, I'm going to come back to some of the logistics that of course you're going to help us through with and help us understand as well. But let's just go to Saif. Saif, here in Johannesburg, watching the election as well, researcher in the field of Pan-Africanism and African Renaissance. It just tells me quite a bit also about the kind of work that you do. So in essence, we're looking at Kenya, a test for democracy that absolutely is, you know, on the top of my bucket list when I look at Kenya and I look at democracy and I look at that part of the world, you know. So would you also call it a test for a test for democracy at this particular point in that particular world, considering also the neighboring countries and sometimes what particularly happens in that part of the world, and maybe Kenya is just operating a little differently, but is it a test for democracy?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
It is really a test of the democracy. Kenya is, as you know, it's one of the biggest economy in the Eastern Africa.
Mm.
And we can consider it a lower middle class range.
Mm.
Considering the nature of, you know, geopolitics in the Horn and in East Africa,
mm.
it's the most stable country for the last half a century.
Mm. The most stable country.
The most stable country, you know.
Sure.
Comparing to the other neighborhoods, you know. The success of Kenya is the success of, you know, East Africa and Horn of Africa. I think we can consider both politically and economically as the leading. I mean, you can figure out Kenya is a leading a nation in that area.
Mm.
So this is enormous significance in so many ways. But you mentioned one good thing which struck me the most.
Yeah.
You know, when we think of governance in Africa, we think only the presidential race.
Mm.
So it hangs only on two or three people. So that we don't give, you know, more attention, you know, the Senate and the local governments at all. That is pretty much problematic.
Mm.
So now governance, it shouldn't be only the top two or the top five whatsoever.
Absolutely.
But you know, it's very unfortunate, but we have to take it from there. And it has also historical nature, you know, Kenya. This is the fifth presidential election. And unfortunately, even though the country is very stable, the election goes by ethnic lines, you know, unlike some other setup in Horn of Africa. Mostly, I mean, this is the nature of election in Africa, but it became very particular since 2007. The Kenyan election is somehow aligned with ethnic arrangement, you know, the top three or the top four ethnic groups. So, I mean, assumption, I don't know, or we can go out of this ethnic line or we stick it into it. I think Daniel also, you'll give us some brief explanation on that. I think when you read the next question, I'll give you some statistics and where we are about. I mean, that's with, which I would like to take, yeah.
Because following the trend as well, I noticed that ethnicity is something that is a considered factor on that side of the world. But let me stay with you, Saif. And Kenya then in the region, and of course you're talking about one of the biggest, you know, in economies in East Africa, fifth presidential election. Some of those elections, not the greatest, you know, for Kenya, and they wouldn't be really proud of those. One, for example, in 2017, the violence and the murder also that happened to that, you know, electoral officer at that particular time. There were lengthy courtroom dramas, all sorts of things challenging that particular election. So Kenya also doesn't come out of, or hasn't always been, you know, the kind of Kenya that we see today, where, you know, the president himself is voluntarily stepping down, you know, and handing it over to new contestants. In other parts of the world, you would either find a coup and or you would find someone trying to stay on, you know.
Yeah, look, that's why, you know, I'm saying, you know, there are hiccups here and there in Kenya, but mostly comparing to Somalia, Ethiopia, Tanzania, pretty much, and Uganda, it's more, I mean, it's a democratic nation, you know, they have been exercising that. Yeah, there are some events, as you say, 2007, the election and post-election violence, you know. Kenyans lost like 1,200 people out of that. You remember also there is a long drama of international, what was that, international criminal courts and so on. But apart from that, you know, if you let me take you back a bit, maybe Daniel Arap Moi, you know, before like 20, I mean, I think it's 30 years, I think. You know, once he opened up for, you know, multi-party system, Kenya became, you know, a symbol, I think, as a model for Horn of or East Africa in so many ways. That's what I can see. The most troubling factor in Kenya, which I see, is this, the ethnic line, you know. Remember, not only, you know, economically, you know, politically as a democratic nation, in terms of, you know, the Western classification of democracy. Also, don't forget that Kenya has been more of Western aligned type of countries. It will not go through the revolution like the neighboring country of Tanzania, maybe Ethiopia, and Uganda, even Sudan. So pretty much stable because it has been aligned, you know, with the Western Hemisphere. But still, it's considered Kenya is a representation of the West, you know, which we can't deny in so many ways. So we have to see from this perspective. So for me, it's huge. I mean, this election, you know, the election result will be anticipated, you know, by many considering this historical fact. To tell you the truth, I mean, for there was no interruption of this presidential election. All the presidents out of four, three of them were Kukuyus, I mean, from the Kukuyu tribe. So this time around, we might see the Luo or Kalenji, I mean, that is, which we'll see in the next, I think, 24 or 48 hours. So we hope this a bit of shift from the trend, you know, for the usual trend for the last 50 years. Yeah.
Sure. Let's go to Daniel. Let me go to Daniel then. Daniel.
Let me just correct, like, or just clarify a few points.
Sure.
One, first, you say like the current president Uhuru Kenyatta is voluntarily stepping down. He's not voluntarily stepping down.
He has to, right?
That's the law.
I raised it in context of other African countries where you would either see one wanting to stay on, and or you would see coups happening.
Yeah.
And in essence...
That's a space that Kenya moved away from in 1992 when we became a multi-party democracy. So from 1992, when we had the former president, who was also a challenging, by the way, back then, and when we got into the new multi-party constitution era during that time, we gave presidents term limits. And that's why the president at that time, though he'd served before, he had to serve two terms.
Mm.
Or he ran for office for two terms.
Mm.
Of course, he won those elections, even in very not very democratic circumstances. And then at the end of the second term in 2002, he had to retire, and somebody else had to take over, who also took power for another 10 years.
Mm.
And that has been the process with which how we've gone here.
Mm.
Are we a democracy? Yes, we are a democracy, but also we're still in the process of perfecting this democracy.
Mm.
Like you can remember, we've had a lot of cases before. The most significant is the 2007 one, which led to, the death of more than 1,000 people and the displacement of more than 600,000 people, both internally and outside the country. Mm.
Which resulted also in the ICC investigating one of the present candidates.
Yeah, one of the present candidates and the former and the current president as well. The current president and one of the candidates in the current elections were also suspects.
Mm.
And they were tried before the ICC courts, and of course their cases were dismissed in very interesting circumstances. But that putting that aside, Kenya has been a country that has been each and every time trying to perfect its own democracy.
Mm.
The last election, if you remember, this was the first time the results of a presidential election in the whole of Africa were being cancelled by a court of law, and in our case that was the Supreme Court. And this happened, and this also set precedents for the entire continent. We saw about a year after that the High Court, the Constitutional Court in Malawi,
mm-hmm.
also doing the same and nullifying the election of Peter Mutharika. So I think in so many ways, we as a country, we are trying to set standards, but we're also looking at our own systems with each and every election and trying to find out what is it that is not going wrong with this election and then trying to make it better. Like for the current election, if I might just mm-hmm. focus in on this and give you some very interesting figures. Where we are at right now, at just about midnight, more than 74% of the election results are in. More than 74% of the presidential results are in.
More than 74% of the presidential election results are in at this particular point.
Are in at this particular point from the elections, from the close of the polling center at 5 p.m. The original instruments that declares those results have been placed in a public portal by the Independent Electoral Boundaries Commission, which is the body mandated to manage the electoral process in Kenya. And anybody can access that information. And you can go straight to a specific polling center, a specific polling stream, and know how many people in that polling stream voted if those results are already in that system.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, for now, it's difficult to tell who is leading or who is holding which position, because that result is yet to be tallied. And right now, what we have showing...
Early results are always misleading, yes.
Yeah, so but the result, 74%, it's already there, 74% of the total cost.
Mm.
But our TV channels are not able to tally it as fast as it is coming in, because it is coming in as very raw data.
Mm.
So they have to look at physical papers. Everybody has to look at physical papers and tally them. And I think it will take a bit of time for us to know what the situation is like. But just that level of openness and transparency, because democracy is not—it's not just the result of who has won.
Mm.
It has to be we have to be able to see and have the feeling that the process itself was—it
has to be observed. Yeah,
was transparent and was not open to any manipulation at any point. And when I'm just going back to this 74% of the results that they are in, That is the original document as it came from the polling station.
Mm.
So one of the things that we realized with our electoral process that was causing a lot of challenges is that there was a lot of documents changing hands from one level to another. Like I explained, we have six levels in our electoral system.
Mm.
So the documents were going all the way, changing those steps all the way to the National Tallying Center. And by the time they get to the National Tallying Center, that document has been doctored in so many ways. So what we have now is in our law that the result as it has been declared at the polling station, that is the final result. There will be no any other alteration to that specific result. And those are some of the things that we've done, I think, to try and perfect this. And I think like you've noted, the Kenyan election is very significant to the African continent, but also specifically to this region that we are, because of the strategic role we play, not as just one of the biggest economies in this region. We are the biggest economy in the whole of Eastern Africa.
Yeah.
Eastern Africa. We are the seventh largest economy in the whole continent. We have strategic relationship with various partners, whether it's guys from the East, the Chinese, the British, from the guys from the countries from the West, and the process, the having a stable Kenyan society and moving away from the incidences that we had in 2007 and the years before is very integral, because Kenya is also the pathway into Eastern Central Africa because of the access from the Indian Ocean coast. So we for these reasons, and also for our own selves as a country, we want to we want to move away from the ethnic balkanization, from the politics that how we played our politics from before. And for instance, this election that we have currently is quite a game changer.
I am in conversation with Saif Kidane, and he is a researcher in the field of Pan-Africanism and African Renaissance, and Daniel Ominde. He is, of course, in Nairobi, guest, a Kenyan blogger and journalist. I'm going to go back. I want to come to you, Saif, but Daniel was in the midst of telling us that why the Kenyan elections are a game changer. So let's go and, Daniel, finish the concept you were talking to us about, why this election particularly is a game changer and different to any other.
So it's significantly different in that for the first time, we are having an election that's not being run through ethnic alliances. So our elections previously have always been won and lost based on which tribes are uniting with which ones.
Uh-huh.
So, for instance, the current elections, if you go back to the tribal narrative, one candidate, the former prime minister, is Zugo. His running mate for this same election is from central Kenya, Akikuyu. Other top candidate on the other side is Kalenjin. Mm. His running mate on the other side is Akikuyu. So they both have running mates from the same area. If you look at how the voting, from the results that have been coming in, I've just been skimming through the IEBC portal and trying to see what trends look like in the central Kenya region. And you see like that vote is swinging one side, despite the fact that the president himself, the current president, who is from the central Kenya region, is actually supporting
Odinga, right?
Prime Minister. He's supporting Odinga and not his deputy president. But that support has not resulted in votes from his end. I mean, from what I've been looking through that portal, I've been seeing through that portal, he's barely managing 30% in that region.
Oh.
So that really shows you in terms of how the game has changed. And for the first time in this election, and this could be as a result of so many factors.
Okay.
One of them is the state of the economy. There's a lot of unemployment.
Daniel, I want to get to that separately, Daniel, and have a separate conversation about that. Let me go to Saif for now and have a conversation before we even get to the economy. I want to understand, and I'm going to come to you, Daniel, about them as well. Well, you have Ruto and you have Odinga. You have William Ruto and Raila Odinga.
Odinga, yeah.
Yes. So, Odinga, yes. And one is 55, the other is 77. So I'm not even going to make age an issue yet. And maybe age is an issue. You know, I do see quite a significant difference between William Ruto, who is also the vice president at this particular time, and Raila Odinga, fifth run at presidential elections. Let's understand how you understand these two particular candidates. Park their running mates for now, and just speak to who they are, what they've done, and why they're important in various aspects in this particular election.
I think this both of them are a very familiar face for a number of years in the Kenyan politics.
Sure.
Odinga, you know, let me put it this way. I mean, most of the Kenyan politics, it goes within the, what do you call it? It's not like as a kinship, but among, you know, the elite. That for a long time. Odinga is also the son of the Kenyan first vice president.
Yes.
After independence. So you can see some sort of, the family business among the Kenyattas, the Odingas, whatever. And maybe next time we might see the, what do you call it, the second president, Daniel Arap Moi's son. So
they keep it in the family.
Come again?
They keep it in the family.
Yeah, they are keeping the family, and the Kenyan politics is more of business oriented. I think that Daniel, he might give us some sort of explanation about that. So these are very rich families. I mean, Uhuru Kenyatta is one of the richest guys in the country. You know, he owns so many things. Remember, Kibaki, also one of the richest guy in the country. Also, he's from the same family, has been vice president for a long time during the Daniel Arap Moi era, even including Jomo Kenyatta era. So, still, we had never seen the Kenyan election outside of the known family. I mean, you can say William Ruto, he came from outside, from humble beginning, whatever. But he is also now a very muscular in terms of, financial terms.
And he is the vice president, right?
Yeah, he is a vice president. He has been in the business and the political business for the last 30 years. So he is not outsider at all. So in Kenya, you can't see, something very radical, unlike, in the region. That's why, I always say that Kenya is very unique in nature, in a political nature, it might be part of, the culture and so on. And they had never gone through the political turmoil like socialism. Beside, the Mao movement in the early or late 50s. That was very short time. And after that, they joined the Western Club, including Jomo Kenyatta. So they had never been out of that group. So Kenya is basically a capitalist country in the Horn of, in the Eastern country, unlike Kenya, Uganda, or Ethiopia, Somalia, in Sudan. So we consider it as an imperialist agent in that region,
sure.
For a number of reasons. So so that culture is there. I mean, when you look at it, will not go out. I mean, it will not be outside of this political elite. Basically, they are heavily armed with finance. So that is what I would like to say. Maybe I will come back with the other explanation.
Yeah. Absolutely. Let's hear what Daniel's got to say. Daniel, the same take on you. Give us your take on. Of course, you're close to them. When I say close, I mean proximity. You're in Nairobi. You've been reporting on them. You've seen them. You've watched them over time. You know who they are in essence. So tell us about William Ruto and Raila Odinga.
So just like is mentioned, both William Ruto and Raila Odinga are a bit sort of veteran politicians, despite the age difference. Raila comes from a very political family. Like you mentioned, his father was the first vice president. Himself, he served as a former prime minister, in this country. But even before that, he served as an opposition leader. He's been in a lot of these political parties, including KANU. At one point in 2007, when we had the post-election violence, Raila Odinga and William Ruto were in the same political party. And the current president, Uhuru Kenyatta, wasn't supporting a different political formation. Right now, we have them just changing roles. So what happens with presidential elections in Kenya is the political vehicles that they use to move into the election with are usually formed for that one particular purpose. For instance, in the 2013 election, allow me to just go back.
Sure. Please do.
The party that President Kenyatta ran with in the 2013 election is not the same party he ran with when he was going for re-election in 2017. So we form very special purpose vehicles. It's not like we have the ANCs and the EFFs that you have in South Africa or the rest of political parties that are there by structure, because our political system in Kenya, it's very difficult for one political party to win the elections alone. So they always have to align themselves with another political party for whatever interest they have or interest.
And
or
a particular individual.
Yes, and sometimes individuals and what the kind of clout that individual carries.
Okay.
So that's how this individual gets there. But in terms of personalities, Raila Odinga is very well known as a freedom fighter. He fought, like I mentioned, the multi-party democracy that we have here. He was a significant face in the struggle for the second liberation of Kenya, which was the fight that brought us multi-party. He's been detained. He's been, you know, he's been beaten on the street. He's really suffered for what he has today, or the kind of following that he has today. When you look at William Ruto was a very staunch KANU man, and KANU is the party that former President Moi used to run. He was a youth winger in KANU, and then he started, you know, developing in politics, becoming a member of parliament, and then going through the ranks until, you know, he became a minister during Moi's administration. And of course, when they joined hands with Raila Odinga in the last election, in the 2007 election, where we had the government of national unity, he was a minister in that government. Then later on, he went to form government again in a different coalition with Uhuru Kenyatta. He's been the deputy president, and of course the last bit of President Uhuru Kenyatta's term, where they had a fallout because again of Uhuru Kenyatta's alliance with Raila Odinga, and he's been, of course, despite that fallout, he still remained to be deputy president because, again, according to our law, a president cannot fire his deputy because they are elected on the same ticket, unless the deputy decides to resign by themselves.
Yes.
So that in terms of personality, that's what, so they come from a very, Ruto has been very aligned to the state for most of his career. He's been an insider of the state for most of his career. Raila has been on the opposition side for most of his career, and his biggest track record is that of a freedom fighter, of somebody who fights for the rights of the common man. So significantly, that is the difference between them. But they both come from very, you know, they both have a rich history in Kenya's political sphere. And possibly just to pick on a point he was mentioning, that it's like Kenyan politics are very expensive at whatever level, even that of an MCA.
Yeah.
The presidential candidates spend hundreds of billions of shillings to run their campaigns. And that's why it's a club that's been left for a few. Even in this election, we have two other candidates. The two other candidates will barely get 1% of the vote each, because they are, you know, the normal guy, you and me.
Are there three presidential candidates or four?
There are four.
Four presidential candidates.
Yes. So the other two are, there's Reverend, there's Pastor David Mwaura, and then there's Professor George Wajakoya.
Okay.
And they... and they're polling like less than 2% combined.
Okay. Let me ask you something about where you said the president cannot fire his deputy president, right? So William Ruto could not be fired by the president that's now exiting. He's been absolutely critical of the president or the sitting president. And I want to ask, and is that because of the context you have just provided, or is it because also of that particular handshake that was struck, you know, with President Uhuru at some point that Raila Odinga had, you know, and they talk about it as the handshake? So is it because of the political context and the vehicles that they ride, you know, and that particular context that you have given, that Ruto has been so critical sometimes of Uhuru Kenyatta, or is it that handshake that particularly has played a role where he, in essence, was not endorsed, but Odinga was endorsed?
So it's the same thing. It's the handshake and the endorsement is the same thing. Mm. So Odinga was not endorsed at the handshake.
Yes.
The handshake happened very, very early in 2018, almost immediately after the last election.
Mm.
So what he did to Ruto is that he felt threatened. Look, we had this plan with Uhuru Kenyatta. Uhuru Kenyatta was going to finish his two terms,
yeah,
and then after that he's going to give it over to me.
Mm.
And this other guy was always going to be our perennial competitor.
Mm.
But now here was a case where who is shaking hands with this guy? This is a guy who was fiercely competing him in the last election. This is a guy who even went as far ahead as swearing himself in as the people's president.
Absolutely, I remember that.
Yes. that was largely felt by people in the president's camp as being prisoners. This is somebody they felt that should be in prison. But here, Uhuru was coming and being buddies with him. And this is something that Raila has been known for. He'd shook hands with former President Moi at some point in 2002, if I'm not wrong, and then got into KANU, and then by the time he was leaving, he left with the whole of KANU. He shook hands, of course, with President Mwai Kibaki, and now he was shaking hands with Uhuru Kenyatta.
Mm.
Naturally, William Ruto would have felt threatened because, again, he's been in the same political camp with Raila Odinga. He knows how he plays his politics. He's a very calculating politician. So it is that being threatened by Raila's presence in Uhuru's inner circle.
Sure. Daniel, I want to go to...
That now caused the friction that him becoming very critical of Uhuru Kenyatta's administration. And the key, let me just make this point. And the key thing he criticized Uhuru Kenyatta's administration for was that Uhuru Kenyatta was being sidetracked from focusing on the agenda that they had for the country for Uhuru's last term into doing something new in terms of trying to change the constitution.
Sure. Let's go to advocate Sipho Mantula, who's joining the conversation right now and who also is somebody who's learned and comments regularly on these kind of developments. Advocate Sipho Mantula, welcome, sir. How are you?
Brother Denzel, good evening in Jambo Africa to your guests who are very informative and laying down the Kenyan elections that we are following. Brother Denzel, I'm speaking as a former observer, by the way. I was in Kenya in 2017.
Sure.
Under the AU. Controversial ones, as they will know, that there was a dilemma, there was a mayhem that David Maraga had to nullify those elections. But as they were talking about the hustler and the dynasty, I thought of this guy of a spy, you know, George Wajaku. What is their take on him being professor of law, talking about legalizing cannabis, exporting hyena testicles? You know, it was so funny about this.
And he could be, and he could be a thorn in the side, because one of the things that you need to achieve in these elections is the 50 plus one.
Correctly, it is 50 plus one, and again, as they know, the EBC, again, the electoral management of Kenya, it is still something that people feel that it is still in the center of the state. Now, it is my second point, what I want to understand from them, that it can be a philosophical or a political question. Their understanding of the phrase of a deep state. What is the deep state that is behind the scenes in the Kenyan elections, not only for now, but even from 2013, you know, but even from the 2007, because I think the issue of the deep state has been masked, you know, when we are talking about elections in Kenya. And finally, Denzel, I will say to them, what we will expect for this election is it is not to see the same issue that happened in 2007 and 2017, because that brings Kenya back into the footing of not being democratized, but the deep state comes back into that. Somebody is running Kenya behind the scenes in terms of saying who should be the leader. And hence, I think your guests were very clear of trying to navigate the hustler versus the dynasty. And the hustler in this case being William Ruto and the dynasty being Raila Amolo Odinga. Brother Denzel, thank you very much for this opportunity. I want to touch on the Maasai. What does the Maasai vote mean as well? Moso Uhuru Kenyatta gave them a cold shoulder, you know, for some point. Can the new leadership that comes into Kenya, will they focus on the rights and the conditions of the indigenous people of Maasai? Because today, in the global calendar, Brother Denzel, is the day where we commemorate the indigenous people across the globe.
Sure.
Asante sana.
Ah, Advocate Sipho Mantula, always a pleasure hearing from you there. Let's go to Sahif. Sahif, quite a few issues raised there by the advocate, who also, as you heard, was an observer in the 2017 elections in Kenya, raising some interesting aspects as to the other two dark horses in this race. And I don't want to say dark horses, because obviously Daniel is telling us that, you know, they could be getting 1%, well, you know, estimates from 1% to 3%. So that's not playing a massive role in essence, but it does become important when you do have a third candidate and you do have a scenario of needing to achieve a 50+1 kind of situation, and somebody just taking elections to a second phase. But the advocate raised also quite a few issues there of the Maasai vote, which I suppose is quite an important aspect within the context of you know, Kenya. And Daniel, I want you to mention that as well. There's the element he's talking about of the deep state, who's actually running the state, Kenya being a democracy, but there's always these hands in the pockets and somebody else is just moving the puppets. Is that a reality here, Daniel? I'd love to hear your comments on that. So, yes, let's start with you, Saif.
Yeah, thank you so much once again. Yeah, look, you raised a good question, but in terms of the Maasai, you know, they are less than 10% in terms of numbers, so they don't have, you know, a significant number. At the same time, don't forget that they are pastoralist society, so they may not be in one place, so their votes, it doesn't make, you know, big change at all. So let's take it that way. But the second thing, you know, I see the dynasty is to Ruto, right? Not rather to what they call it, for Odinga. But my point is not that, you know. Let's look at from African perspective. That's which will help us much. I think Daniel, he will give us, you know, he'll break down the, you know, the election from Kenya perspective. But let me look at from African perspective. That is, you know, we can't afford Kenya to fail, you know, as East African nation. That is, we have to bear in mind. So all our prayers are with Kenyans today, just to come out, you know, with a peaceful resolution or peaceful election. That is what I'm thinking. But we have to touch also other points in this regard. You know, everything is not rosy as we think in Kenya. You know, there are so many problems is running like any other African nation. Beside the elections, there are critical areas which bothers us too much. Remember, Kenya is hosting more than 500,000 refugees in the country. That from Somalia and South Sudan. That is a huge number. I think this is an estimate. It might be much bigger than this number. So the failure, it might be another displacement of this refugee at the same time, Kenyans. But the other things which you have to understand is Kenya is facing a very terrible time, especially this time around. The unemployment rate is skyrocketing. The food market is totally untouchable. Kenya is, by the way, it's very known, one of the corrupt nation in corrupted system, you know, in Africa. You know, I think next to Nigeria, if I'm not exaggerating, I think Daniel might correct me on that in this subject. And the other things which we shouldn't forget is the issue of terrorism in the country, which is alongside with Al-Shabaab and so on. And there are kidnappings, so many unrest and so on. And one important thing which I would like to raise is, you know, most African leaders, at the end of their term, they will create so many chaos. I think Uhuru, he tried just to moderate some of these things. You know, it's a very terrible region. And most leaders, including him, they are Pan-Africanist when at 11th hour. You know, nationalist at the same time and ethnocrat with the same talk. The recent clash, you know, between Rwanda and DRC is somehow orchestrated, not orchestrated actually, you know, Kenya has also muddled in that arena. Remember that it will reflect in this election and so on. The annexation of DRC to EAC is another challenge which is created. You know, DRC is now a member of SADC, at the same time the member of EAC, also a member of Central African Community. A lot of problem which you see in that region. So we can't avoid wanting at all. So there are so many reflections, so many problems which will reflect in this election. But as I told you, it's more of a dynasty in Kenya. So we shouldn't expect something miracle.
Okay.
So every supporter, you know, from aside from representation, there are so many factors also which bothers us a lot. That's which I would like to say. Thank
sure.
You.
Let's go to Daniel. Daniel, then let's start with issues that the advocate would have raised. Raised a few issues. Let's get some of your. He also wanted to hear, you know, some of your sentiments in this regard. And I'm going to then lead the conversation also then into the economy aspect as well, because Kenya sitting where it is just absolutely, you know, so important to the rest of Africa as well. And, you know, if they get this thing called democracy right, then obviously Kenya is the next powerhouse. But let's start with the kind of statements and the kind of comments the advocate was making.
So if I look at the significance of Professor George Ojakoya in this race, I mean, he excited the race when he came in, but eventually it's all leveling down, and that kind of, you can see that from the kind of votes he's getting from today's elections. I mean, he's getting really insignificant numbers. Of course, any single vote that any other candidate other than the two leading ones get can really play a role in preventing them from reaching that 50+1 threshold. So yes, to the leading candidate, that is of concern to them. But to everybody else, I think it's just something about let's wait and see, you know, what is going to be managed. And then it's a conversation we will take further in that whole context of the radical proposals he has. But I really, like, from a very personal level, I really don't look at the proposal, especially the one for marijuana, as something that's extremely radical. I mean, in Africa here, Malawi have legalized, you know, to some extent, certain use of marijuana and cultivation. Mm. You know, where you are in South Africa, you know, there's a level of use of marijuana in certain environments that's legal. Mm. Uganda, next door from Kenya, is moving towards legalization of cultivation. Kenya, in terms of our current laws and our current administrators, they have refused this, but it's not like that position will not change. I mean, globally, we are getting you know, new research, new science that's telling us of, you know, some of the benefits of marijuana and of course vis-a-vis the harmful effects, but that's not taking away from Kenya being a very conservative society. But if you look at how our economy is going again, some of the cash crops that we had relied on, like tea, coffee, sugarcane, you know, the rest, them, they're not performing as well as we would have wanted them to.
Is that because of the drought? Is that because of the drought rather than anything else?
It's not really just because of the drought. It's because of a wide array of factors, including management, including, you know, prices in the global market, including, you know, better production technologies from other countries, the lack of us being able to, you know, do value addition to these problems, to these products, the whole chain of factors is really wide, and I would not like to get into it right now. We may not finish having this conversation, and I might not also be an expert in that.
Sure.
But I think he has started a conversation that will also propel us to the next level. In terms of minorities and ethnic minorities, I think as a society, that was the other issue, the learned trend, the learned gentleman, rather, raised.
Yeah, the advocate,
Yeah, the Maasai's or the ethnic Maasai's, they have representation, very good representation in parliament. They control as a community at least two administrative units, what we call the counties, out of 47. Of course, they're not among one of the you know, top three largest ethnic groups in Kenya, but I think there's a bit of fair representation. They have fair representation in terms of public appointments, whether it's in the executive as ministers, on the judiciary, or in other arms of government, of public service. So, but I think that's something that's a process where we are continuing. Remember, Kenya is moving. Like I said, we are a democracy trying to perfect itself.
I have to ask you, and I have to ask you this. Saif raised it, and one of the things I wrote down that Saif raised was next to corruption, you know, Kenya could be second to Nigeria where corruption is concerned. Just how much of a role does corruption play in the political space? Let's leave, you know, in the business sense or in general, you know, whether we talk about corrupt society and that. But in the political space, how huge a factor is corruption, and why is it such a massive, massive factor? And why is it also something that Kenya would seemingly then not be able to rid itself of?
I mean, just look at how expensive Kenyan elections are.
Okay.
For a candidate to run for president, to have a significant stab at the presidency, I mean, you need to have at least five teams flying out every day with two different venues to conduct rallies in choppers.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the cost of an election for one candidate would be put at around, you know, $2 billion or more.
Okay.
This is money they are not going to earn in the 5 years. This is for a 5-year cycle. This is money they won't earn in that 5 years as salaries. Mm. So how are they going to pay that back? Where are they getting the money to fund this?
Mm.
And what interests do those people funding them or giving them those kind of finances to fund this? What interests do they have, and how are they going to repay them for those interests? Like that is why I don't think there's anybody who would be like a top candidate for the presidency in Kenya who has no level of corruption, who will have no level of corruption.
My question to you then is this kind of behavior happens all over, and particularly also, I mean, when you look at the United States and look at that democracy, and you look at those particular candidates and how much money they have to, you know, garner just to run elections. If you look at, you know, the kind of elections run here in South Africa, and you look at the Cyril Ramaphosa race for the presidency, I just want to make this particular point about that. So people do raise money and they do raise funds. Are you saying that in Kenya particularly, that these kind of funds are linked to to people and business people with absolute interests in the running of the country, and those people are the hand that then drives the president over the next 5 years?
Yes, precisely. That is what happens here. And you see, like in those other democracies that you mentioned, there are actually laws that govern fundraising. Mm. In Kenya, we tried to institute that law. But you see, these laws have to be instituted through politicians. The politicians themselves in parliament, they shut those laws down. There's a law that intended to create a cap to financing of all elective positions. That law did not see the end of the day. I mean, the light of day. And basically, the perception, and this is, I mean, I might not really have hard facts until you present documents saying, oh, candidate A was funded by candidate B, and these are the contracts they are going to get, or these are the contracts they get. But we've seen over history, we've seen the huge corruption scandals that that have been there over the time that we've had. The current government, that its time is coming to an end, the government before that. I mean, for each and every government, there's always at least one mega corruption scandal that runs into hundreds of billions of shillings.
Mm. Let's take a break.
There's always...
Well, Daniel, you wanted to complete the sentence?
Not really, but yeah, I think that was the point I was making. Like, there's always, you can always do correlate these races or the money spent in election campaigns with the corruption that's bedeviling this country.
Sure.
But all the candidates in this election, they are both promising to be the cure. They are both promising to fight this menace, but without clearly telling us how they are going to do it.
Sure. Daniel, we're going to take a break. Saif, we're going to take a break. And on the other side of this, we're going to begin to round up the conversation of what's going on in Kenya and what an important election that is. And we should all be watching it, because you're going to see over the next 5 years the new leadership come to the fore and what Kenya is then going to develop into. And Kenya has developed over the last couple of years. If you have been watching politics and democracy and how that economy and that political space and business in Kenya has just evolved over the last 10, 15 years, amazingly so. It's just not the same country anymore. We're in conversation with Daniel Ominde. He is a Kenyan blogger and journalist based in Nairobi, and of course, researcher in the field of Pan-Africanism and African Renaissance is Saif Kidani, and he is here in Johannesburg. Saif, I want to come to you now, and you know, quite I'm learning as we just absorb what Daniel tells us about the kind of country Kenya is becoming. I want to talk a little bit about the economy, and you know, it was Daniel who said seventh largest economy in Africa at the moment. Let's talk about this. The pandemic impacted it. Russia's assault on the Ukraine has to have impacted it. There is economic graft or corruption that happens in that particular country. You heard Daniel just speak to that. There's also the drought that's happened over many, many years. There's subsidies on flour and gasoline. There's the debt to China, which is massive in essence. And I'm told, and reading up on Kenya's debt, it's about $74 billion in essence. So I want to put it to you that whoever wins here has harsh economic realities to deal with.
Yes, indeed. As I said before, you know, there are so many challenges now Kenya is facing. We have talked about, you know, the good things what Kenya is inspiring the entire continent, specifically the East African, you know. Kenya is considered as ICT hub for East Africa. You know, they have a wonderful, excellent companies which can provide you, you know, service. Like we consider the Kenyan institution, especially business, is more dynamic than the use of Tanzania, DRC, and the South Sudan, Ethiopia, and the whole region. I mean, they have very dynamic institutions. Also, don't forget that Kenya has a wonderful civic society, which is very admirable in so many ways. The civil servant as well. It's nearly, I mean, in Africa, I think the top top three or top five. So they have this all positive aspect in Kenya, which we can't deny. But also, as you mentioned, you know, we have to also mention the increase of this burden, which is mostly from China, high inflation rate, which is also another issue, and the geopolitics tension, which we can't avoid, you know, in terms of the Somalian war against Al-Shabaab, you know, they are also involving what they call it in that route. I mean, they are sending, you know, troops time and time again. Also, don't forget there is a conflict zone between Somalia and Kenya. Now, I think Somalia won that specific area of that petrol, whatever areas in the offshore of the sea, I mean, on the Red Sea. There is still that area is, it will be another challenge. Yeah, but however the case may be, is Kenya is a wonderful place. And don't forget it's a number one tea exporter for the world market. And their flour export is number one in Africa. I mean, this all is a positive input for Kenyan economy. By any means, you know, the private sector is the top three or top five in Africa, which that is unavoidable. Also, Mombasa is serving, you know, Uganda, as well as South Sudan, because this country is also, I mean, landlocked country. So there are so many positive factors in this regard. And, but we shouldn't forget, you know, the economy is in the hand of few. That is the most challenging part of the Kenyan economy. Especially Kenyan Indians are the most influential businessmen in that country. I mean, the, almost, we can say 70 or 80% of the business is run by Indian Kenyans. And so the land issue is there still, which is, it's not resolved yet. And we consider, I mean, Kenya is a capitalist country in so many ways. I mean, if you ask me, the true capitalist country in Africa is the only which I know is so far is Kenya. It has positive part and it has also a negative area, you know, which some of things which we cannot, you know, emulate from Kenya, including the election, you know, pumping billions of dollars into unproductive process. So that is the way I see it. But for sure, as I said, you know, before, we would like to see, you know, a positive result out of these things. Did I answer your question? Or
absolutely. No, that's perfect. I want to, in fact, I want to just go to Daniel. And Daniel, I want to add to that a little bit, and I'm going to recap on what he's on what Sahif has been talking about, the economy in essence. But we're talking about the drought and the subsidies that are in play over there. He did also talk to the debt to China and then your overall debt in essence. And then, you know, the pandemics, you had COVID and then there's the Russian assault on the Ukraine. I want to add, though, you know, that, you know, in Kenya and part of the technology that's beginning to happen there is Kenya is beginning to be an absolute burgeoning techno hub. And that has to also be taken into consideration that, you know, things are beginning to happen in Kenya. So, you know, on the one hand, you've got all the kind of negative impacts, but on the other side, you've really got a techno technology that's coming to the fore in Kenya that seems to be driving the continent as well.
Yeah, I think one of our biggest exports to the world is going to be technology. I mean, and it's no brainer why Kenya is referred to as the African Silicon Savannah. In Nairobi, we have like a very booming tech industry, and right now it's not just in Nairobi. If you go to, you know, Kisumu, a city in the western side of the country, you'll find, you know, several smaller tech hubs just coming up. You'll find tech hubs in Eldoret. You'll find tech hubs at the coast in Mombasa. So, like, and this is what is even attracting, like, the, you know, blue chip tech companies like Google and Microsoft.
Daniel, not to disturb your train of thought, Daniel. Why is Nairobi, you know, becoming one of the world's largest techno hubs? Why? What's driving that?
I think Kenyan just realized what potential that we had in terms of the skill sets that our young people have. The median age in Kenya is around 20 to 22. I'm not very sure about, but it lies between. So like, that's a very young age. These are people in campuses. Yeah, most of Kenyans' youth today have a level of tertiary education. Some of them go into you know, technical colleges.
Oh, he's gone. He's gone. We're going to try to get him back just to talk and finish that particular point about the economy and particularly the techno hub that's happening in Kenya. And he was telling us that Nairobi, in essence, as we try to get him back, we're trying to get back Daniel Ominde, the Kenyan blogger and journalist. And we were talking about why Kenya, particularly Nairobi, is becoming a techno hub in that part of the world. And he says it's a no-brainer, actually. You know, if you see how the world is going and how the world is developing, then, you know, we're going to be exporting the kind of technology to the rest of the world. Daniel, you back? Daniel?
Yeah, sorry for that. So let me just wrap this up very quickly.
Yes.
I think the basic reason is that, one, from the year 2002, we introduced free primary education, and that level, and then that has since transited to, you know, subsidized secondary education, and then that has led to a lot of transitions from secondary school into universities. Our universities teach a lot of technical sciences, so that's why even from a very, you know, very early ages, of the university courses, you find students are already playing around with designing solutions for various problems. But then also we have these tech hubs across the country that people who are not even pursuing technology or computer science related subjects have access to, and they try to go there and create whatever solution that they feel like they can have for that has been domesticated, a solution that's going to solve specific problems for the society. This is how we came up with M-Pesa, which is basically the mobile money, you know, transfer platform that has now taken over the world and has been replicated in many other countries. So it is the youth, but the government has also, from the Kibaki administration, the government has also intentionally invested in technology. Today, Kenya has one of the fastest internet connectivity, you know, speeds in the whole of Africa. Today, our internet penetration across the country is at around 70%+. So it is a sector because so people have a lot of access, a lot of information. People are able to go online, see what their peers are doing in other parts of the world. Our young people are able to, you know, to experiments just by themselves in solving the solution, creating, you know, applications, whether they're web-based, whether they are SDK, whether they are, you know, mobile applications, to solve those specific problems that people have here, and now trying replicating it. Together. But then we also have like a wide pool of technical people with technical skills that now these companies like, you know, Microsoft, Google, and the rest feel like they can have these people working from them from here, including Facebook. Facebook, I think, has its Africa operations head running from right here in Nairobi. So that's just some of the examples. And some of these could be seen in other parts of the continent. For instance, Twitter went and set up its, you know, its African base in Ghana. And I think there's a lot of things to learn from what's happening in Kenya, other than the few challenges that we have that these people who are coming into power are going to deal with. One of the candidates has promised, you know, free education all the way to university. I hope that's practical enough. I don't know how we are going to manage that with the kind of economic challenges that we have. But talking about economic challenges, There's the issue of debt, and right now our debt is at about, you know, 9 trillion shillings. Some of these are to the Chinese. We've been floating euro bonds over and over. Even in the domestic market, there's a lot of our banks right now are trading in government bonds and securities instead of, you know, issuing loans to people to customers, and that in a way is stifling the growth of industry here, but the banks feel like it's safer doing that. That's one point I want to correct from Yusuf's from the point he was making, was that the 80%, 70 to 80% of the economy is run by the Indians. That's really far from the truth. The biggest backbone of Kenya's economy is the small and medium enterprises, and it's majorly the local people that are running those enterprises. Of course, we have a significant number of Indians in the big money and big business space, but the Kenyan economy is by and large run by the small and medium enterprises.
Daniel, thank you so much.
Let me correct that within 2 seconds.
Sure, Saif.
Look, I didn't say that 80% is run by Indians. I said 80% is in the hands of few individuals. But one last point on the ICT.
Yeah.
The reason why ICT is booming in Kenya is not because it's a miraculous strategy. I had been there, you know, since 2002. I have been following this area. The only thing is the Western countries, they chosen Kenya as a hub. They were pumping a lot of money. Otherwise, you know, every African child is brilliant. They can, we can create, you know, so many apps in different parts of Africa. Thank you so much.
Saif and Daniel, thank you so much for the conversations tonight. It is midnight, and I have to thank you for participating in what is obviously an absolutely important conversation and an absolutely important event that we're going to be watching over the next couple of days. Daniel Ominde, I will obviously invite you back to, you know, to this particular platform next week. Saif, we have to have these kind of conversations as Kenya goes through this democratic process. So next week sometime, please, let's look at post the election, and when the results are out, let's have that conversation as well. Thank you to both of you gentlemen for an absolutely stunning conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And that's Daniel Ominde. He is a Kenyan blogger and journalist. And of course, Saif Kidane is a researcher in the field of Pan-Africanism and African Renaissance.
You've been listening to a Power 98.7 podcast. For more podcasts, visit power987.co.za or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.